Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining us as we continue to go through the big old monster box of baseball cards from the 1980s and soon 1990s, the early 90s. My collection pretty much stopped in 1993. And in my opinion, that's when the fun stopped in the hobby back then. It did come back, though. It's all come back. And I thank you for coming back to our podcast as we're taking a look at 1989 Fleer. Our random pull, card number 432, Jamie Moyer, or all my years covering hockey, I'm very tempted to call him Jamie Moyer, but it is Jamie Moyer. Pure chance that we pulled a Chicago Cub card here. And I'm being honest here. I've got a little stack of 89 Fleer, and I just randomly pulled one. And there you go. It's Jamie Moyer, who was actually young back then. We'll talk about Moyer in a little bit. We'll talk about the 89 Fleer set. And we'll also get your comments from Wax and Gum Stains. That's our Twitter feed in just a little bit. But first of all, congratulations to the Chicago Cubs and their long-suffering fans. 108 years between world championships. The Cubs' previous world championship came during the Roosevelt administration, and that's Teddy Roosevelt, and there were 46 states in the United States of America. You've seen all the historical notes there, but basically five generations of humanity had passed between world championships, and that was an exciting series, an exciting Game 7. My goodness, it didn't get any better than that. And if you're a fan of sports, period, if you're a fan of baseball, period, even if you're not a fan of the Cubs or Indians, if you could care less about either team, you had to love that series, and especially Game 7. That might have been the best Game 7. I know a lot of people were bringing up the 91 series between the Twins and Braves, and I agree with you there. If it doesn't surpass that, it's right up there. But I've got to tell you, as a sports fan, I didn't mind one bit that I was up until about 12:45 in the morning here in the Eastern time zone watching that game, despite the next day having a roughly 16-hour day at work. So I know a lot of people were groggy yesterday morning, but that was so worth it. It was absolutely worth it. Congratulations to the Cubs and their fans, and congratulations to baseball. I mean, that series, and especially that Game 7 and all the storylines that went into it, that really, I don't want to say it may have saved baseball, but it finally put baseball back in the spotlight for the good reasons. And there's a lot of good things about baseball and Major League Baseball, but, you know, when you think of all the controversy over the last 20, 25 years, be it steroid use, be it other PEDs, be it, you know, the work stoppages, you know, the major one in 1994. You know, there's a lot of negativity throughout the years with Major League Baseball. But for once, you had this really authentic series, this authentic moment, this moment where, and I've seen the ratings, I mean, an estimate 40 million people watched Game 7. I mean, the country embraced this sport again, and that is just awesome. We're picking apart why the NFL is suffering in TV ratings. We're bored to tears with regular season basketball games, and even I work for a hockey team. You know, people, they trudge through the month of November, you know, when you're talking regular season hockey games. But the nation was able to embrace baseball, and I think that's a great thing. So kudos to Major League Baseball for having the stars and planets align, having the World Series play out the way it did. And I would be curious to see, even in the markets where the teams are not that good, I'd be curious to see next year if you have an uptick in attendance, if you have an uptick in TV and radio ratings, and if you have an uptick in kids signing up for Little League Baseball. That's really the best sign from this World Series. And I certainly hope that's the case, because even though baseball's had its ups and downs, it's had its moments, good and bad, we still love the sport. Even in its most simple form, even if it's not Major League Baseball, you still love the game of baseball. And especially after that World Series, you've got to love it. You've got to love the sport. If you didn't before, you probably really do now. And my heart goes out to Cleveland Indians fans. 3-1 lead in the series. Talk about a punch in the gut. And I can only hope for your sake that the Indians are back in it next year and that they win. Very much like the Royals a few years ago, you know, lost to the Giants in 14, beat the Mets in 15. I really hope that's the case, because if any city deserves their baseball team to come up victorious after the Cubs finally did it, boy, Cleveland really needs the Indians to do it now. And I really hope that, again, they can win it sooner than later, because I know the Cavaliers have a championship. I know that ended that 50-plus year drought of a professional sports championship in Cleveland, but you really have to feel for the Indians fans after how that series went. And Lord knows the Browns aren't going to be winning anything anytime soon. So, Tribe fans, I hope you're back in there next year. I hope you're celebrating and planning that victory parade. But in the meantime, everybody loves the sport of baseball now after that tremendous World Series that wrapped up just a couple days ago. So, pure chance that we've got Jamie Moyer here. We'll talk about him. We'll talk about the 89 Fleer set, which I've grown to like. There was a set that I was never a big fan of. I'll tell you why in a little bit. But over time, I've really liked it. And it's a very, very good set. And of course, there is a legendary story about one card in particular. And it was brought up by one of our listeners at Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed. And I'll bring that up, of course, talking about card number 616, not just your average infielder for the Baltimore Orioles, Billy Ripken, not holding just your average baseball bat in that shot. All right, talking about Wax and Gum Stains, again, that's our Twitter feed. You're more than welcome to chime in at any time, talk about the sport, talk about the hobby, talk about our podcast, as we'll interact with you. So any questions, comments, whatever, go ahead and chime in at any time, and we'll continue the conversation online, even when our podcast isn't coming your way. And it does come your way every Tuesday and Friday via Audio Boom and also via iTunes. We made that announcement several days ago. I've noticed a big, big uptick in listeners coming from iTunes. So if you're new to the podcast, thank you so much for joining us. Pass on the podcast, pass on the Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and just let everybody know about this. I appreciate you tuning in. The short story about me is I'm 39 years old. I have a wife and two kids. And just like you, many, many years ago, you know, 25 or so years ago, I collected baseball cards, much like you did, and loved the hobby, bought every set, got out of the hobby about 20 years ago. Got rid of a lot of my cards, still hung on to quite a few of them, but really the crux of this podcast is a lot of the cards I hung on to from the early to mid 80s. Like I said, up through the early 90s, I still have some, and most of them are living in this big monster box, and we're going year by year, set by set, and just kind of looking at the sets and looking at the players in our random pulls. So that's the short story of what we do. The long story is in episode 1 of the podcast, which, by popular demand, and a lot of it started actually from us appearing on iTunes, I dug it up and I posted it. And that really gives you the long story. It's about a 30-minute story of how I got into the sport, how I got into the hobby, why I've been able to fall in love with the sport and the hobby again over the last few years. And it's a storyline that I find a lot of collectors have also followed. You know, they abandoned the sport, they abandoned the hobby maybe 15, 20, 25 years ago, and finally came back around for a lot of the same reasons that I did. And I won't share them with you here. If you want to check it out, episode 1 is available on iTunes and on our Audio Boom page. All right, as for your comments on Wax and Gum Stains, a lot of them talking about the 89 Donruss set, which we discussed in the previous podcast. Our good friend Waxpack916 talking about the kid, Ken Griffey Jr., makes 89 Donruss and Fleer. Without his rookie card, these products would be just like 88 Donruss or 89 Score. Now, pretty accurate with that comment there, as 88 Donruss was not a bad set, not a bad design, just had really a pretty weak rookie class, even though it did have some notable players like Tom Glavine and Roberto Alomar. They come off the top of my head. But 89 Score, yeah, if you don't have Griffey, it'd be tough to compare 89 Donruss to 89 Score because the score set was just miserable back then. But you're absolutely right. You know, Griffey carries the rookie class for the 89 set, much like he does in Fleer, but certainly in the 89 Donruss set. That is one of the reasons why a lot of people still enjoy that. Ben Adams, I like 88 Donruss. Overproduction of that set is only negative for me. I know I'm in the minority on it, though. I think you're finding more people, Ben, who like the 88 Donruss set as well as 89. And really, the only knock is the overproduction. People like the design. They like the affordability of the set. They like some of the stars that are in there, some of the rookies. It's just there's so many of them that, you know, a lot of people don't want to invest in it because, you know, you spend $30 or $40 building a set. The value of the set is much less than the amount of money that you put out there. So it's really more for collectors who like the design of the card and also like the collection of players, not necessarily the amount of money that they can resell it later on down the line. RJ, 630, love 89 Donruss. I do too. Again, it's a set that's a little underappreciated because of the overproduction, but I've always liked the design. And as I mentioned in our podcast, it was the second baseball card set I was exposed to as a kid. Topps from 1989 was the first, and Donruss was the second, and it was very easy for me to collect. Joey W. found us through iTunes, just got started, and I love it. We're same age and collected same stuff. Hope you have one on the Billy Ripken Fleer. Well, Joey, that actually leads us nicely into our discussion of 89 Fleer, as the Billy Ripken card is the most memorable card. Because, well, Joey, if you're my age, in 1989, you would have been 12, 13 years old. Depends on what month you were born. But anyways, you're a teenager, basically. And when you see the words that were written on Billy Ripken's bat, you giggled. You loved it. You know, hardcore collectors are like, oh, here's an error and here's a variation. For us kids, it was just like, look what's on his bat. He uses the F word. And I'm not talking about face. It was the other F word in front of face. And I know it's a podcast. It's the internet. I can say anything I want to. But, you know, being raised on FCC guidelines throughout my college career, I try to keep it clean here. But if you're a collector, you know what was written on the knob of Billy Ripken's bat. Fleer card number 616. That's not our random pull. Again, we'll get to the Jamie Moyer card in a little bit. But a little story behind the Billy Ripken card. The backstory is sometime during the 88 season, and a fan who has a website dedicated just to this card, BillRipken.com, has a little bit of the backstory here. Sometime in late June 1988, the Orioles are in Boston, and Billy Ripken is just out doing batting practice. He's just kind of milling around. Well, a photographer says, hey, can I get your picture for the Fleer baseball card company? And Ripken says, oh, sure. And he picks up a bat, and picture's taken, and that's it. Well, not so fast, as the bat that he has selected has the famous profanity on the knob of the bat. Fleer somehow doesn't see this, and in the initial run of cards, the profanity is right there for all to see, and Fleer panicked. They absolutely panicked, because even though this was a hobby and a collector's type of hobby by then, where people were buying and selling cards, not merely collecting them for their own happiness, this was the type of error card you don't want, because you still have kids buying these cards, and it made the Fleer company look absolutely ridiculous. So while the profanity card is popular, the part that really changed the marketplace was all the various variations, as you had, at least by my count, four different variations. You had one where it was just scribbled out, almost like with a Sharpie marker. One where it was kind of scratched out, only partially. One where it was scratched out almost completely. And then the one that I believe mostly still survives is the one that had a big black square covering it up. So you had five versions of this card. The initial run with the profanity, Fleer tried to stop that before they sent out all the other cards. So there was more value to the profanity one at first, but then people started figuring out the different variations and started assigning prices based on however many scratched out versions there were, however many almost completely scratched out versions there were. And like I said, I believe the one that is in most production is the one with the big black box. I may be wrong on that. But of course, the story is you've got the five different versions of the card. The one with the profanity is the most popular because, hey, who doesn't like a baseball card with profanity? And then, of course, poor Bill Ripken, he claims that these bats that he was using, he got a shipment of bats in from Louisville Slugger, and he was just going to, you know, number them all and put them into a storage area. Well, he claims when he got the order and he was preparing to write his number on there, it was almost time for batting practice. He was going to be late. So he just wrote something that he would be able to look at very quickly and say, oh, that's my bat. Well, seeing what was written on the bat, there's no doubt this was a very unique piece of lumber that he was reaching for. So, you know, Ripken says that this order of bats, they were too heavy, so he just used them for batting practice, hence the reason why that picture was taken. It was during batting practice in 1988. He just picked up the bat, didn't even think about it. Picture was taken, card was printed. The profanity was out there for all to see, and everybody was embarrassed. But now, here we are almost 30 years later, and Ripken is kind of having a little fun with this because, let's be honest here, Bill Ripken, his career, he was basically a, you know, utility infielder, never really reached any kind of stardom. Of course, he had an older brother who was kind of a little more popular than he was. So Billy Ripken's legacy, other than being a fine analyst on the MLB Network right now, is a baseball bat with some really nasty language on it. But it's an interesting story behind that particular card, and you can find it again, BillRipken.com, BillRipken.com. That is the super fan who has created this website, just kind of chronicling the story behind one of the most legendary baseball cards in the history of the hobby, and it's very entertaining to look at and read some of the backstories to it. So that is the most popular or most well-known card from the 89 Fleer set. Of course, you also have the Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card, number 548. You have the Randy Johnson card, which has some variations. There was I believe it was a Marlboro ad in the background of his baseball card, and there was the original version, and then Fleer, realizing that they were basically giving free advertising to a tobacco company, decided to block it out. So you've got a couple versions of that. Also, you have Gary Sheffield, Craig Biggio, John Smoltz, and the rookie class from the previous year. You've got Tom Glavine, and you've got, of course, all the stars that had matured from the late 70s and early 80s. So a very desirable set of cards in terms of star power. Also a very good rookie collection as well. And this was a set that was very welcomed by collectors. This was a nice set. It was very similar to the Donruss set in the sense that it was only 660 cards. Was it overproduced like every other card set in 1989? You bet it was. But I don't think it was quite the overproduction that we saw from Topps or from Score in 1989. There's still a gazillion of these cards out there, but fans are more willing to buy the 89 Fleer set than, say, 89 Bowman. Of course, we discussed the size issues with the actual size of the card there, or certainly other sets, like I said, Score, even Topps that year. Even though the 89 Topps set is popular for its design, there's still so much out there from that set that people tend to gravitate towards Donruss and Fleer because they're not quite in as much overproduction, even though there are still plenty out there. And it is an easier set to collate. Again, 660 cards as opposed to 792 or 800, depending on the other sets that you're looking at. Now let's take a look at the particular card that we selected here, Jamie Moyer, card number 432. You look at the front of the card here, you have old man Moyer, actually young at this time, in his delivery, chucking a 62-mile-an-hour fastball at Wrigley Field. And one thing that I like about the 89 Fleer set is something that Fleer started in 87, and that is trying to provide some kind of 3D perspective with a lot of their cards. And they were definitely able to do that in 89 because you have the rather sharp diagonal borders that set up the frame of the picture. And even though the 89 Fleer set is taking up by a lot of frame, if you will, you know, the actual photograph, the action shot of the photograph, if you will, only accounts for about 60, maybe 65% of the front of the card. Still, they were able to make it work to where it looks like Jamie Moyer is actually leaping out of the card at you while he's making this pitch. And if you look at other cards from that set, and I'm thinking the Griffey Jr. card, of course, and he's just, it's a pose shot. He's just standing there holding a bat. Same with Gary Sheffield. You know, he's just kind of milling around holding a bat. Still, they were able to put the frame of the photograph in the background while the player was in the foreground, and it provided for a very unique kind of 3D effect, not necessarily jumping out at you, but kind of giving that effect that the player is in action here and kind of bigger than the actual card itself. So it's a pretty unique setup that they have here. Player's name in the upper left-hand corner along with his position, team logo, which, of course, I'm a big fan of, in the upper right-hand corner. Down in the bottom right-hand corner, you've got the Fleer logo. And then, as I mentioned, the photograph taking up only about 65% of the card, but still, because of where they position the framing of the photograph, the player was able to kind of stand out a little bit. So even though there's an awful lot of space being taken up by this, I call it a fence, actually, this fence-like border, the Fleer company was able to make most of the pictures work to where the players stood out. And it took me a long time to like 89 Fleer because there was just so much space taken up by the border and not necessarily the picture. But as I said before, over time, I was able to come around to it and really liked it. I liked the overall look of the set. When you flip the card over, you've got a very typical Fleer back to the card. You've got that fence look at the very top and very bottom of the card. Also, the complete stats of the player underneath his personal information card number in the upper left-hand corner. Along with the stats, you have the vertical stripes, this time going with a yellow and white look. Now, Jamie Moyer's career at this time was very early in the making, so you have the Did You Know? Little factoid box beneath it. And then one of the cool things about 89 Fleer, and I mentioned this before, something they started doing in 87 and continued in 88 and 89 and even into 90, they would come up with these very unique splits for a player, for, you know, a pitcher. Where was his best pitches? You know, where were they being thrown? How did they perform at daytime? How do they perform at night? How do they perform at home? How do they perform on the road? Well, in 89, they decided to look at how a player performed before and after the All-Star break. And you have this really funny cartoon of this baseball player just loafing around in a hammock right in the middle. And it says the All-Star break and the guy's sleeping. So you have before, in Moyer's case, wins, losses, earned run average, and then after. So you could see, was this a guy who, you know, started out of the gate really hot and kind of petered out as the season went along? Or was it a Mr. October kind of situation where a guy would get hot with a little rejuvenation the last 2-3 months of the season? So I've always liked that, even though the statistics that they share don't necessarily tell a really big story like you saw in 87 or 88. Just having that cartoon of the baseball player sleeping in the hammock, I've always liked that. That is a really fun way of presenting some stats. And like I said, Fleer did that in the late 80s and into 1990, and I always found that to be a really cool feature of their cards. A very interesting way to share, I wouldn't say sabermetrics, but certainly advanced stats, breaking things down, like I said, day versus night, home versus away, or in this case, before and after the All-Star break. So that is the overall look of the card, the 89 Fleer set, like I said, still a favorite with hobbyists because the design is favorable. Again, some people don't like it. I didn't like it at first, but I came around to it and like it now. You've got a great rookie class. You've got great star power. The overproduction is the only thing that's holding it back again. And much like 89 Donruss, 89 Fleer is not a set that you buy and sell with the hope of making a ton of money off of. You could still get complete sets depending on where you buy them, anywhere $20 to $30. You can get wax boxes anywhere $15 to, you know, $20. Again, without shipping, these are just general base prices. And I know people who find these sets and find these boxes and are thrilled because, again, it's a very popular set despite the overproduction that we saw rampant in the industry in 1989. My younger brother actually bought a set, a factory set, at a yard sale, I think, a few weeks ago, and he was sharing it with me. And that's great. You know, it's one of those sets where, sure, you can break it open and, you know, pull out the Griffey card. You can pull out Sheffield and Johnson and see which Billy Ripken card is inside. Or you can keep it together because it's just a really cool set. You know, it's a good set that has a lot of good options. And much like 89 Donruss, if you happen to have $30, $40 to spend and you just want to collect a good set with good design and good stars, 89 Fleer is definitely one of those sets. So don't look to make a lot of money off of it. Just add a nice little piece to your collection along the way. Now, as for Jamie Moyer, you know, we joke about age here, but really what he did in his career was absolutely amazing. Moyer here pictured with the Chicago Cubs. This would be his final season with the Chicago Cubs in 1988, because by 1989, he was already pitching for the Texas Rangers. Now, he was drafted by the Cubs in June of 1984. And in December 1988, involved in one of the biggest trades in Chicago Cubs history, as he was sent with reliever Drew Hall and some guy named Rafael Palmeiro to the Texas Rangers for Luis Benitez, who never got out of the minors, Pablo Delgado, who never got out of the minors, Paul Kilgus, Kurt Wilkerson, Steve Wilson, and the wild thing, Mitch Williams. Now, it's an interesting trade because the Cubs, of course, would go on to win the National League East in 1989, despite not having an up-and-coming pitcher like Jamie Moyer and certainly a slugger like Rafael Palmeiro. Palmeiro would, of course, go on to be a star first baseman in Texas, later in Baltimore, was disgraced in the PED hearings with Congress in the early 2000s, and also a positive test, which to this day he still denies. Mitch Williams, of course, would be famous for other dubious reasons. He was called the wild thing, not because he was just a wild personality, although that was true. But finding the strike zone was always an adventure with Mitch Williams. And Joe Carter still, to this day, thanks him for grooving a pitch in Game 6 of the 93 World Series, helping the Blue Jays defeat the Phillies for their second consecutive World Championship. And, of course, Mitch has had some issues off the field recently, let's just say, anger management, especially around Little League clubs. So it's kind of weird, some of the parties involved in that trade, but it was big at the time because it helped the Cubs get to the playoffs again in 89. It helped the Rangers start building up to a quality team in the early 1990s. And for two teams that were completely off the radar in terms of contention in 1988, it was a pretty big deal. Now, Moyer's time with Texas was not long. He was released after the 1990 season, signed by the Cardinals in 91, released after that season, signed again by the Cubs in 92, released midway through spring training, and he scratches and claws his way back through the minor leagues through the Detroit Tigers, granted free agency, signs with the Baltimore Orioles in 1992. He was with the Orioles from 93 to 95, granted free agency, signs with the Boston Red Sox. He's with them in 96, and then he's traded to Seattle for veteran outfielder Darren Bragg. Well, after bouncing around again, he finds a home in Seattle where he becomes one of their top pitchers, not necessarily a fireballer like Randy Johnson by any stretch of the imagination, but a very crafty pitcher. And he's a guy who was throwing junk at the plate for years and years and years, but he was able to stay in the league. He was one of those legendary left-handed pitchers who was able to throw these knuckle curveballs that weren't pretty, certainly did not set the radar gun on fire, but got the job done. And he was part of some very successful Seattle Mariners teams in the mid to late 90s and into the early 2000s. Moyer would then be traded by Seattle in August of 2006 to Philadelphia. The Phillies were on the way up. Phillies sent to Seattle Andrew Baldwin and Andy Barb, two guys that never made it out of the minors. And Moyer was part of the world champion Phillies team in 2008, and he was able to stick with the Phillies through the end of the 2010 season, also participated in the 2009 World Series, losing to the Yankees. And then when it seemed like he was done, and thanks to injury and Tommy John surgery, a lot of people thought he was done in 2011, he found one more chance with the Colorado Rockies. He signs with the Rockies in January of 2012 and actually makes the opening day roster. And he sticks with the Rockies for just a little bit. And when I say just a little bit, it was a rather unfortunate ending because he did appear in 10 games. But for a junk ball pitcher who was at the age of 49 when he was with Colorado, having to pitch, mile high air and you know, trying to just toss some garbage in the National League, it just wasn't cutting it anymore. So Moyer's career would end with the Colorado Rockies, even though after he was released by the Rockies in June of 2012, he bounced around a little bit, was signed with Baltimore for a few weeks, signed with Toronto for a few weeks, but he never made it back to the major leagues. So here's a guy, we joke about his age, we joke about the types of pitches that he threw, but he was very effective. He appeared in 696 games, starting most of them, 638 of them, over a 25-year career. Win-loss record of 269 to 209, earned run average of 4.25. So again, really wasn't blasting bats into pieces with the stuff he was throwing, but he was effective. 2,441 strikeouts to 1,155 walks. That's basically a 2-to-1 ratio. No matter what you're throwing at the plate, that's not a bad thing. You're actually doing very well. I mentioned that he did win the World Series in 2008 with Philadelphia. I can also tell you through much of his time in Seattle, he was a pretty dependable playoff pitcher, especially during their tremendous 2001 season, which ended in the hands of the Yankees. Of course, the Yankees were just a juggernaut that year before they hit Arizona in the World Series. But this was a guy who could be counted on to deliver in the postseason. Again, not blasting the ball by anybody, but able to just fool enough with his pitch selection, his craftiness, as we like to call it. You know, when you lose a little bit of speed off of your fastball, you become a crafty pitcher. And he was certainly able to do that. Now, after his baseball career ended, he was in broadcasting briefly, part of the Philadelphia Phillies broadcasting crew in 2014. But after that season, he decided to become a full-time dad. And why not? He's got 8 kids, a couple of them adopted, 6 of them natural. And when you've got 8 kids, you need to spend a little time with the family. I don't blame you one bit. And one interesting note about Jamie Moyer's family, his wife, Karen, the former Karen Phelps, the daughter of Digger Phelps, a longtime ESPN broadcaster, they got together in the late 80s while Jamie was with the Chicago Cubs, and Karen was an intern working for the Cubs broadcast department. Who was the matchmaker for Jamie and soon to be Karen Moyer? The one and only Harry Carey. That's right. Harry Carey. Hey, Jamie. You got to check out this hot broad working for us in the production truck. I don't think it went like that, but the story goes that Harry and some of the people in the production staff were trying to get Karen to date one of the ball players, and eventually before the end of, I want to say maybe the 86 season, I might be wrong with that, but while Jamie was with Chicago at the end of the season, Jamie and Karen hooked up, and they've been together ever since. So how cool is that? Harry Carey hooking up an intern with the player. And by the way, that's a no-no in sports. You're not supposed to do that. It happens, but you're not supposed to do that. Well, they've been together ever since then. Like I said, they have been raising 8 children. And also it should be noted that they started the Moyer Foundation. It's a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping children in severe distress. And that is a very cool thing as well. Now, the Moyer name is not completely gone from baseball. In fact, 2 of his sons are playing professional ball. Dylan Moyer was drafted by the Twins in 2010. He played in college for a few years, didn't sign with the Twins. He is now a member of the Dodgers organization, which drafted him in 2013. Also, another son, Hutton Moyer, was drafted in 2015. So, while we joke that Jamie Moyer was around quite literally for 4 decades of Major League Baseball, he was a very productive pitcher. He was a guy that did win a World Series. He managed to win 269 games, just throwing anything he possibly could at the plate. And the Moyer name is going to continue in baseball, more than likely with 2 sons already trying to work their way up into the major leagues. And I'm still just blown away that Harry Carey was the matchmaker. Hey, Karen, you should meet this guy. His name's Jaime. Let's go have a bud and talk about the latest episode of Cheers. It'll be fun. What do you say? All right, what do you say? Either about my Harry Carey impression or the story of Jamie Moyer, the Billy Ripken card, or the lovable collector favorite 89 Fleer set. Again, you can join us at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter at any time to talk about that. And we'll be back on Tuesday as we wrap up our final look at the 1989 sets. My favorite from that year, and a very personal reason for that, the 89 top set will be front and center on Tuesday. Again, talk with us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. Look for our podcast on Audio Boom and iTunes every Tuesday and Friday. And if you're looking to advertise your business, we are open for business. DM me on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains, and we can talk about how you can sponsor our program, and we can help share your product or service with our great listeners. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for listening to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic.